Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
To all the patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
Yes, McDonald's iconic Big Mac is turning 50 next month, but don't expect its recipe to change anytime soon, even if a whole lot about the way we eat has changed since 1968. Healthy foods are all the rage now, so are lots of trendy diets, along with plenty of confusion about what makes a healthy diet. This hour on Point, what Americans are eating 50 years after the Big Mac. You can join us on air or online. Is a Big Mac still your guilty pleasure? Have you started eating more avocados, peanut butter, fish, and other healthy foods high in healthy fat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let's start off from New York with Candace Choi. She's a food industry reporter for the Associated Press. She wrote a recent column entitled 50 Years On, McDonald's Isn't Messing With Its Big Mac. Candace, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Anthony.
Hey there. So tell us, if you would, let's go back 50 years. Tell us the story of the Big Mac. Remind us of its origins.
So the Big Mac, like a lot of McDonald's most popular menu items, was the idea of a franchisee. And this was a franchisee named James Delegati in the Pittsburgh area. So he came up with this sandwich, and he has admitted that it was modeled on another popular sandwich at the time by the Big Boy chain. So that went on the menu. He tested it in Pittsburgh. It did very well, and then it made a national launch the next year in 1968.
Didn't it have a sort of false start? Didn't he goof up on the bun? Did I read that incorrectly?
Well, so actually McDonald's is very, you know, it's known for being very control freaky with its menu. And so when he finally got permission to test this burger that he had created, McDonald's made the stipulation that you have to use our standard bun. You can test it, but you have to use our bun. But the bun that McDonald's had, it just didn't work. It was too sloppy, I guess, trying to cut it into thirds. So Delegati sort of struck out on his own and just used his own sesame seed bun, and the rest is history, I guess.
Right. So the Big Mac first hits the McDonald's menu in 1968. So here's the advertisement that hit the TV screens nationwide and launched the burger to fame shortly afterward.
It starts here with a lightly toasted bun, and then a pure beef hamburger, a slice of cheddar blend cheese, and some crisp, fresh lettuce. Then, our own secret sauce, the club slice, toasted, another hamburger, and the sesame seed crown.
And the sesame seed crown. Candace Choi, how is it doing today? We're 50 years on. We're going to be celebrating, or marking anyway, its 50th birthday next month. Is the Big Mac still as popular as ever? What did you learn about that?
So around the world, on a global basis, McDonald's says it's still its most famous burger or most popular burger. In the U.S., they don't disclose what the most popular burger is, but I'm certain, you know, you can say that the Big Mac doesn't take up as much, it doesn't account for as much of the sales for the chain sales in the U.S. as it once did. I think immediately after, it accounted for as much as 19% of McDonald's sales. But today, you know, with the Quarter Pounder and given how much their menu has just grown so much, you can be confident that it takes up a lot less of that.
Right. And in general, how about McDonald's in general? What do we know about its popularity? How many people are going there? Or is there any way to measure that?
Yeah, so they do have to disclose some numbers, you know, as a publicly traded company. And within the U.S., which is, you know, its big flagship market, they're growing globally. But within the U.S., they've actually been reducing their number of stores. So they've been shrinking their store base in the U.S. And then even at the remaining stores, the number of customer visits has been declining. So, you know, that's really a really important measure of popularity that a lot of analysts on Wall Street watches. You know, how frequently are people visiting? And that figure has been declining.
Interesting. And so what's the reason for that? What's replacing it? Is it this move toward healthier eating, new fast casual restaurants? What's going on here?
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea that it's a move toward healthier eating is sort of like too simple, right? Because when you have a chain that's as big as McDonald's and you have this proliferation over the years of so many different more options, it's like, how do you hold on to that dominance when there's just a growing number of options, right? If people can go to, you know, not just Chipotle, but there's so many different places that people can go, it's just hard for McDonald's, even if people still like McDonald's, for them to be as dominant as they once were.
So over the years, McDonald's has added things like fresh salads. They've gone to fresh meat patties instead of frozen meat patties. They're doing, and I learned this from your reporting, by the way, they're doing fresh apple pie, baked apple pies instead of deep fried apple pies. Mm-hmm. Are they considering messing with the Big Mac?
I think that when you have something as, you know, like iconic as the Big Mac, it's really hard to make any significant changes without people getting upset because they're so nostalgic about it, right? It's sort of like the whole fiasco with New Coke. Even if, you know, you don't eat a Big Mac anymore, you might have like memories about it. And if you read that McDonald's is changing something, then you might, you know, get upset and you have that emotional connection to it. So I don't think they can really change the Big Mac itself in any significant way. But what they've done is like limited time offers where they have something called the Grand Mac or the Junior Mac, where the beef patty is bigger and may look more like, you know, the burgers you might get at In-N-Out or Shake Shack, and they look a little more updated.
Well,
so
Candace,
I think they, yeah.
No, go ahead. Sorry, no, go finish that thought, Candace.
Oh, yeah. So I was just going to say, while they're not changing the core Big Mac, they'll do little promotions like that to make it a little more contemporary.
All right. That's Candace Joy. She's a food industry writer for the Associated Press. You can find a link to her recent article on the 50th anniversary of the Big Mac. Candace, thanks so much for joining us now.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Listeners, for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about what America eats now that the Big Mac has turned 50. How have your diets, how's your diet changed, and how are you eating more healthfully? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Lisa Sasson. She's a professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University. Lisa, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Anthony.
Hello there. So as I said, we're going to be talking about what America is eating for dinner now, 50 years after the Big Mac, about diet trends, the good ones, the bad ones, about healthy fats, unhealthy fats. But let me just sort of make this transition from the Big Mac now that it's 50 years old. Do you believe there's still a place in our diet for the Big Mac?
Well, it's here, and it's probably here to stay.
you don't sound hugely enthusiastic about that.
Well, because I think once in a while as a treat, sure, it can stay in the American diet. The problem is that it's not a treat for many people. It's a lot of people eat McDonald's daily or a few times a week. So as a treat, sure, once a year, once in a while, but having it too often is certainly not healthy.
Right. So give me your quick summary about how the country's eating habits have changed since the Big Mac was introduced 50 years ago. What's a good way to think about what has happened since then?
Well, what's good is that I have some perspective of this because I've lived through a lot of that. And I remember when I was a kid, going to McDonald's very rarely was such a treat. It was maybe twice a year, and you were so excited when, you know, my friends and I would go to McDonald's. And now it's not. It's not a treat. It's something people do too often. What's changed undoubtedly is more awareness. As the science has evolved, we've become so much more aware of the link and the connection between what we eat eat in health. This is pretty fairly new. We understand there's a correlation between foods we consume and chronic disease or promoting health or feeling good. I always equate food diets to fashion. They keep evolving and they keep reinventing themselves. So diets from the past, from the Scarsdale cabbage grapefruit diet, they just reappear as, you know, the South Beach and now intermittent fasting, etc. So dieting is, and fad diets are just a trend. What's changed, I think, is people are eating or trying to eat more fresh ingredients, less processed foods. And I have to say that that is, though, very regional. When we look at America, there are pockets of America where I think that a lot of the diet habits haven't changed. So I think that's important to note that as a country as a whole, there's variations. If you go to certain neighborhoods, all you see is fast food outlets. And so the people are consuming. They don't have much of a choice. And then a place like Manhattan, all you see now when new restaurants open are those fast casual restaurants you mentioned, where salads, where you actually watch the person preparing your meal, where you have the sense that you're involved in the making of your food. So you're seeing a lot of salads, lots of fresh ingredients. I think people want to eat healthier and a lot more juices, cold, you know, believing that perhaps that's healthier, lots of less soda.
So, Lisa, with all this attention on fresher foods, healthier foods, are we seeing healthier outcomes in people's health? I mean, in other words, is there some way to measure, are people actually healthier today?
Again, it depends where we do the measurements.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that we still overeat. We eat way too many calories. We're not active enough. And we're still eating a lot of packaged foods. So both things are happening actually simultaneously. We're seeing that people are more aware, they're trying to eat healthier, but we see a lot more of unhealthy foods, such as the beverage industry.
Right.
And, you know, the aisles are just filled now with beverages and misleading advertisements about, you know, added sugars and all these other sweeteners.
Lisa, hold that thought, because we're going to pick this up. And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned this long string of trendy diets: Scarsdale, Atkins, South Beach, high carb, low carb, no fat diets, the Mediterranean diet. Now we have the paleo diet, the keto diet. We're going to tick through some of these later in the show after the break, get the best advice from our panelists and your calls. We're talking about which high-fat foods, for example, can be good for you, and about healthy diets in general. You can join the conversation. Are you including high-fat foods in your diet? What diet trend have you tried with success or without success? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about what we're eating these days and about which trendy new diet can help or hurt you. You can join the conversation if you tried a keto or a Mediterranean diet. Did it work? What challenges did you face? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And all this conversation is happening as McDonald's, as the Big Mac celebrates 50 years. So here's actress Halle Berry, one of the many celebrities who follows the keto diet. She spoke to talk show host Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest last year about how the diet has helped her keep healthy and maintain her figure.
The idea of it is you don't eat sugar and you train your body to burn healthy fats. And so I eat healthy fats all day long, avocado oil, coconut oil, use butter, but don't have sugar. So that's the secret.
But a lot of experts remain skeptical of the high-fat diet. Here's nutritionist Joy Bauer, who told the Today Show in January that the lasting health effects of the keto diet are still unclear.
We really don't have large-scale studies for the long term on healthy people. I don't know what happens when you tax your organs and you really restrict carbohydrates. So this is a plan. If anybody has underlying health issues, you want to speak with your physician first.
I'm talking with Lisa Sasson. She's professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University. And I want to introduce from Baltimore, Courtney Ferreira, registered dietitian and founder of the Real Food Court Nutrition Consulting Group. Courtney, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard that sort of back and forth about the keto diet. Let's start there. Courtney, I'll start with you. What do we know about it? What do you think about it?
Great question. Keto diet is so popular right now. So, you know, as a dietitian, I have worked in the hospital, in the clinical world, and I do like to educate people on what the keto diet was created for. It was created as a medical therapy. So, especially in children with seizures, they see better quality of life on this type of diet. And I like to let people know that to reach true ketosis, like for children in this situation.
So wait a minute, this is what we're talking about, trying to reach true ketosis, right?
Correct.
Explain what that is, just because I know we're going to throw some terms around here. I want to make sure everybody is up to speed.
Right. So true ketosis is when your body does start using fats for energy, and you see the ketone levels in your blood rise. Now, some people, you know, regular people kind of walking around, no health conditions, may say, oh, I'm doing the keto diet, when really they're just making an intentional decrease in their processed carbohydrates and increasing fats and protein in their diet. They may not be in a true ketosis.
Okay, interesting. Lisa, what's your view on this diet, which is quite the rage these days?
It is the rage. And I echo the last speaker's comments. People go on the ketone diet, like the Atkins diet, and they eliminate carbohydrates. But for the most part, they're eliminating the foods that probably cause them to gain weight. And that is the snack foods, the potato chips, the sodas, the ice cream, desserts, etc. So those are eliminated from the diet, which is good. The biggest problem is there's lots of healthy carbohydrates, which are fruits and vegetables and whole grains. And those, if you're following a strict high-fat, high-protein diet will be eliminated or greatly reduced. And that's where I have the greatest problem, because those are some of the healthiest foods in our diet and are very important to consume daily.
Listeners, we're talking about how we're eating today, healthy eating, what it means, how you're eating, what are the challenges, what are your discoveries. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Let's take some calls. Sean is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Sean, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hey, Anthony. How are you? I love your show. You're a great presenter.
I appreciate it.
I'm a long-distance trucker, and one of the issues I have is not every restaurant can accommodate an 18-wheeler. And I find that a lot of truck stops have just the fast food. So
what do you do, Sean? What do you do? How are you dealing with that?
Well, when I get home, I go to Walmart. I buy me some fruits and vegetables. I cut them up, stick them in the fridge in the bunk, and get some grapes. And I try to lay off the fast food. I get a Big Mac every now and then, but it's also the speed with which I eat. Most of the time, I'm like a vacuum cleaner, just nailing. I got a big,
All right, Sean, I really appreciate your call, and drive carefully out there. Courtney, let me come to you first. I mean, a couple of things there. I mean, it sounds like Sean is taking this seriously, stocking up on fruits and vegetables. That's a good thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. And what about his point that he's like a vacuum cleaner and eats things fast? Is that something that we should be aware of?
Oh, absolutely. That is such a key factor in how much we eat, our weight. We eat too quickly. We don't taste our food. We don't savor our food. We don't enjoy it. And we overeat as a result. I actually recommend that people not refill their utensil until they've swallowed what's in their mouth. And even just giving that a try for one meal, especially if you're eating with other people, you're going to realize, wow, I was eating really fast. And wow, I taste my food more when I slow down.
Yeah, interesting. I was struck, too, by one of the things that Sean brought up. And Lisa, you touched on this earlier in the hour, and that is because of his industry, because he drives a truck and shows up at truck stops and they don't have a whole, you know, great range of healthy food options. That's the kind of limited set of choices that a lot of folks face in parts of the country, right?
Exactly. But if you are at a fast food restaurant and you have no other option, you could still make healthier choices, the best choices possible at the restaurant. There are ways, because sometimes you are stuck, and you know what the last speaker said is great, that he brings things, but you still could make better food choices, even at a fast food restaurant, I think.
Do a salad, glass of water instead of a burger.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's like the soft drinks. That could be the demise because they're cheap, unlimited. People may buy those 64-ounce cups and keep drinking as he drives. So the first thing to go is the beverage because that doesn't fill you up, doesn't lead to satiety. So that would be the best thing. And the second thing, is there a salad available? Do you have to have the bread, all the condiments? So is there chicken, skinless chicken? There are some options that may be healthier.
Let's go to Christine. She's calling from Somerville, Mass. Christine, you're on the air. Great to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you, Anthony, for taking my call. I just want to share that for me, what seems to be the healthiest is not a fad diet, but I do best when I really eliminate particularly refined sugars, but sugars in my diet. And one of the challenges that I find is something that's so frustrating is that sugar seems to be hidden everywhere, and it almost seems that it's on purpose. You know, you go to buy something that you wouldn't expect to have sugar in, and then I read the back of the label, and there it is. So I would like to hear your panelists just speak to that about the health benefits of reducing sugar in our diet and just my perception that as Americans, we're just completely over-sugared to begin with.
Yeah. Courtney Ferreira, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There is sugar in so many food products that we don't even realize. I think that you're doing the right thing. You're being an empowered consumer. You are turning over the label and looking what's in your food. You're not just assuming, you know, that it's something that doesn't have sugar. You're checking it out for yourself, and that is so important. Truly, we want to stick to natural sugars as often as we can. You know, if it's a special occasion, if you really have a craving for, you know, a really good cookie from a bakery, it's okay to let yourself enjoy those things. But when we're consuming all this added sugar from these food products without even realizing it and we're not aware, that's really not good for us.
Right. And I guess one of the things to be aware of, too, is when you read the ingredients, it's not just the word sugar you're looking
right.
for. It's the word high fructose corn syrup, for example, which seems to be in just about every other thing on the grocery shelf. Right, Lisa?
Absolutely. And it's not. There's about 20 different words for sugar that's on a label. High fructose corn syrup is one. But there's many other words, and it's sprinkled all over the label. And I think the best way to decrease the amount of added sugar, don't buy a lot of processed foods, and don't buy foods with labels. Fruits, vegetables, all of these foods contain sugars, but they're not added. And I think there needs to be a distinction between foods that have natural sugars, which we want people to consume, a yogurt with no added sugar, fruits, vegetables, etc. And then there's all those other products that have added sugar. And the biggest problem is people think that certain added sugars are healthier than others, and they're really not.
Sugar is sugar, in other words.
Sugar is sugar is sugar. And I always say there's nothing wrong with having a little. Have what you enjoy. If you like a little brown sugar sprinkled on something, then go for it. But don't believe it's healthier because it has a little bit of molasses or some vitamin, because you would have to consume so much to get a significant amount of that nutrient. So I think that's an important message. It's all added sugars.
Mm. So if sugar is bad and to be avoided, I want to talk about something else around which I think there's some misunderstanding. For a long, long time, it's been drilled into the heads of some of us anyway, to avoid fat is bad. But of course, we understand now that there are all kinds of really good fats.
Mm-hmm.
So can we talk a little bit about where we find those good fats? Let me start with you, Courtney.
Yeah, great question. I love fats. And there are lots of places that we can get fats in our diet pretty easily. So nuts and seeds, everything from almonds to chia seeds to hemp seeds to peanuts. We also have avocado, avocado oil, olive oil, our fatty fish like salmon. There are a lot of ways that we can get quality fats into our diet.
So why are fats good for us?
Fats are great for us because, one, our body needs them. They help our brain to function, and we need to get some of those from our food. They also help with satiety and satisfaction, and that is a big factor. If you've ever finished a meal and felt like, you're full, but there's just something missing, and then you decide, oh, I'm just going to go for that cookie, that usually is because that we're lacking fat in that meal. We're lacking feeling satisfied. And fat also helps with our blood sugar control, so it helps lessen a blood sugar spike after a meal.
But Lisa, they've gotten a bad rap, I guess, because people don't want to be fat, so they say, well, I'm not going to eat fats.
Right, and that's the biggest misnomer. We overeat, and portions are too big. This is why, and we're not active enough. Basically, that's why we gain weight, most of us. So if you eat too much of anything, you could eat too much vegetables, and if it's excessive, whatever, you gain weight. So fat did get a bad rap. And again, it's like the pendulum swung. And when fat got bad rap, people started to eat lots of carbohydrates, lots of fat-free products, that whole snack-well phenomena. And you know where that led us to. That led us to more obesity, increases in diabetes, heart disease, etc. So fat no longer is maligned. I think we need to think, we shouldn't be looking at nutrients. People don't eat fat. We eat foods. We eat diets. We have dietary patterns. And I think that's what we need to focus on. And when we have healthy fats in our diet, it adds to satiety, it adds to flavor, and it's critical for our health, as Courtney said. There are certain vitamins that must have fat to be absorbed. So somebody who has a big salad and uses fat-free dressing, probably with all these added ingredients, is not doing their body any good because a lot of those nutrients, the vitamins, need a fat medium. And fat tastes good. You know, we should always think about flavor. That's what drives us to eat and enjoy our meals. And fat adds so much flavor.
I agree with that. I want to stick with that, Lisa. Fat tastes good. So here's a disagreement we have in our house. I eat meat. I don't eat a lot of it, but I love the taste of meat. I love the taste of meat fat. Mm-hmm. Should I be eating meat fat, or should we trim the fat off of our meat?
Again, it depends how often. I think you should definitely trim the fat of meat, because even though the healthiest meats, so to speak, would be the ones that are lean, that don't have a lot of that marbling. The problem is the tastiest and the most expensive cuts of meat have the marbling. It adds to juiciness and the flavor. Once in a while, again, Anthony, like I mentioned, having a fatty cut of meat is fine once in a while as a treat celebration. But in general, the rule of thumb would be to start to trim away that fat.
All right. I promise to do that from this point forward. Let's go to Tom. He's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
It's interesting that this subject follows your last program, because you're talking about taxation and health care and all of that. And I think that some of these foods should be taxed according to their health benefits. Or health detriment, because I think that these companies get away with putting this stuff out on the market, and they say, well, people have choices. Well, when kids get addicted to sugar, the parent no longer has a choice.
Tom, I think it's a good point, and I think there's been talk of that in some communities and states, taxing soft drinks, for example. I hear you agreeing with this, Lisa.
Absolutely, but maybe the opposite would be more of an incentive to give people a benefit or something, a reduction, when they buy healthy foods, sometimes a positive. But I think that something like a tax on junk food, that's what I call things like soda and a lot of these other products, it is something worth exploring. Just like cigarettes, you know, they became prohibitively expensive, and you see the people are buying much less.
Let's go to Christy, who's calling from Lakin, Kansas. Hi, Christy, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. I am calling about dairy products and their high fat value. And you guys noted that you need that high fat to help absorb other nutrients. And I just wanted to say, I think whole milk, butter, cheese, all are great high fat options, because they have that high fat, but then they have the 9 essential nutrients that milk has that goes along with it. And I'm not a big breakfast eater, but I always drink a glass of milk in the morning, and I feel good, and I feel full, and I can function for the rest of the day.
Christy, thanks so much for the call. Courtney, I feel like whole milk is another one of those foods or drinks anyway that's gotten a little bit of a bum rap in recent years. Does Courtney make a good point?
Yeah, I'm so glad that Christy called in about this. This may not be the most popular opinion, but I am very pro-dairy, and I am pro-using the higher-fat dairy products. Again, it comes down to satiety. You know, if you're having a fat-free yogurt or skim milk, you're not satisfied, you're going to go looking for something else. And the thing about fats in our diet is we want a variety. So whole milk has a place, but that shouldn't be the only place that you're getting fat in your diet. Variety is key.
All right, listeners, we're talking about America's diet and how it's changed since the days that McDonald's introduced the Big Mac 50 years ago. What are you having for dinner? Are you clear about what constitutes a healthy diet? What questions do you have? We've got a great panel of experts here and a great conversation going. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about healthy eating. You can join the conversation. Has your doctor recommended changing your diet for health reasons? Have you given up certain foods? Does the answer to all these questions we've been asking come down to one word? Moderation. We're talking with Lisa Sasson, professor at New York University, and Courtney Ferreira, a dietitian and nutritionist. And let me introduce from Chicago Dr. Clyde Yancey. He's chief of cardiology at Northwestern School of Medicine and associate director of Bloom Cardiovascular Institute at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. And Clyde Yancey, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for the opportunity.
So when it comes to diet-related health issues, what are you most concerned about? What are you contending with most? What are your patients contending with most?
So as a cardiologist, there's one word that really captures our greatest focus. That's obesity.
Mm.
The consequences of obesity in this country, the health consequences, the economic consequences, and particularly the way in which obesity tracks directly to cardiovascular disease is of paramount importance. We understand that about 80% of all heart disease and stroke that we care for is preventable. And most of the methods by which we can prevent heart disease or stroke really come from lifestyle modification, beginning with weight management and avoiding obesity.
It's wow.
Just that negative.
I want to be clear that I heard you right. You said that 80% of heart disease is preventable, treatable.
Correct.
Wow. That's quite a figure. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes down to lifestyle modification, we're talking primarily about diet, right?
We're talking about diet, but we're also talking about a whole portfolio. We're talking about staying physically active, not smoking, having an appropriate weight for height, mm-hmm. following a reasonable diet, and then understanding what your health metrics are. As we like to say, know your numbers, your blood pressure, your blood cholesterol, your blood sugar. Those seven things I just went through, we know that package makes a big difference.
Yeah. And where are these challenges, these health challenges, most acute? I mean, are we talking low-income communities, for example, or how would you describe where these health challenges are most acute?
So I'll tell you that the challenge is ubiquitous. If we look across our country, easily 40% of our country is obese. And if we combine obesity and overweight, well over 50% of the adults in our country are either obese or overweight. That's a pause moment, Anthony.
Yeah.
And we should all take stock. But particularly in the more challenged communities, especially communities that are African-American, we're dealing with obesity rates that are at 60% or greater, many times not because of a person's own volition, but because of the circumstances in which they live and how they access foodstuffs. So this is really tantamount to a crisis. I know it's hard to ring the alarm on it, But when we understand the consequences of obesity, that all tracks back to our diet, it really does make us understand the necessity to begin to do things differently.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, I'd love to ask you one more question before we move on to some calls. And that is, we had a caller just a short while ago who talked about why not tax high-calorie junk foods that are contributing in a big way to this obesity crisis. Do you think that kind of government intervention would help?
It helps, but let's get rid of the word tax. This really is a phenomenon we know as behavioral economics, using small incentives or disincentives to modify behavior. If we think of this, Anthony, as an investment in our future that allows our children to do better in school, that lowers our healthcare costs, that increases our longevity with a better quality of life, it's no longer tax, Anthony. It's an investment that is intended to fuel a direction towards healthier lifestyles and better choices.
All right. I want to get a bunch more calls in. Jay is calling from Riverhead, New York. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Fine.
Good, great. I'm calling mostly because I was listening to your show, and I'm hearing kind of my life story. I grew up across the street from the McDonald's. I was able to buy food for myself. My parents couldn't control what I would do, and I became overweight. And I was overweight from age, 10 to 20. I don't know. I'm 33 now, so to basically 31. And I just was gaining weight. And I tried a keto diet, and it completely changed my relationship with food. It made me think really hard and look really hard at what I'm eating. What is in what I'm eating? More specifically, you find it's very hard to find foods that are made for mass consumption that don't have added sugars, that don't have unnecessary calories. And I lost 110 pounds. I went from 280 to 170.
Wow.
It completely changed. Yeah, completely.
Jay, congratulations. That's something. So tell me how you're going to keep that weight off. Are you going to stay on the keto diet?
So I've already started the work of slowly transitioning off of it, at least not taking it as seriously as I did before. I kind of realized that I think a lot of people don't realize is that most people have an unhealthy relationship with food. I know I do. And so I know that I have an eating disorder, basically. I have problems with self-control. So imposing restrictions like the keto diet does, because it tends to actually go a lot worse for you if you break it. It's almost better if you never started at all than if you start the keto diet and break it, because you're, kind of messing with your body's natural processes.
Yep.
So you can really swing yourself and do some damage. So I have started to work towards not being as strict, keeping up my level of activity, so I hit the gym as much as possible, and just trying to transition into a healthy way of paying attention to what I eat, paying attention to my portion sizes, making sure I'm getting enough of my appropriate macro and micronutrients, and not needing to be as strict on keto. I actually haven't quite made the transition off of it yet, and I'm a little afraid.
But it sounds like you're on your way. Jay, I really appreciate the call and for telling your story. Thanks so much. Courtney, I want to know, as a dietitian, if you've got advice for Jay as he begins this transition.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm loving some of the points that Jay made. He was able to recognize that this fad diet, and I think this happens to a lot of people, this kind of trendy way of eating was messing with his mind and messing with his relationship with food. So I think he's doing the right thing by slowly incorporating foods. I would actually recommend that if he does feel like he's having some of these mental struggles, he should get help from a therapist or a registered dietitian. I think a lot of these diets they mess with our mind. They make us confused and scared of food, and I never want anybody to feel that way.
Yeah. Clyde Yancey, I'd love to have the point of view of a cardiologist about these fad diets. Do you think, we just heard the caller talking about how it helped him, at least for now. What's your view of them?
I think the most important thing we just heard was the importance of commitment. Mm-hmm. Many times we get confused with all the different choices. Is it what you eat? Is it when you eat? Is it how you eat, et cetera? But ultimately, it really is about portion control and discipline. And I think that once you commit to a strategy, in his case, a keto diet, which was successful, others have opted for different approaches, it really is about that commitment. When that commitment is made, we see good outcomes.
Yeah. Lisa, is there one diet, I mean, among this long string of diets that we've been talking about, is there one diet, I'm going to ask specifically about one diet. It seems like we've been hearing about sort of the positive effects and results of the Mediterranean diet for a long time.
Yes.
Does that sort of hang out there as one that kind of makes sense for the long term?
Yes, I think that the Mediterranean diet is probably one of the healthiest, most palatable diets. And because the basis of it is to eat a variety of food, minimally processed, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, healthy oils, and to have less of the animal products. And it's really, really tasty, and that's one of the main attributes of this diet. It has a lot of variety. It's not boring. And there's many ways you could eat the Mediterranean diet. You could have something like whole grain pasta. You could have brown rice. There's lots of different forms of the Mediterranean diet. And using olive oil, good quality olive oil as the fat is really, really tasty. It actually adds flavor to your food, not just fat. So I think the Mediterranean type of diet, which is not calorie restricted, it's sitting down and having a meal which adds to satiety because it has a lot of fiber as well. So that is probably one of the healthiest diets. And it's really not a diet. It's a way of life. Mm. And so it's a dietary pattern that you follow. So, and once in a while, having those treats,
right.
I think that abstaining from them sometimes leads to overindulgence. So once in a while, having some of those favorite foods we like should be also incorporated.
Right. Let's take a couple more calls. Hannah is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Hannah. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks so much. I'm super excited that you guys are talking about this because I actually entered my grad school program in nutrition because I felt that I was really undereducated about nutrition. And I'd love to hear from your guests about how they feel about conquering the childhood obesity problem, because what I've learned a lot about is that obese kids are more likely to become obese adolescents, and they are more likely to become obese adults. So if you don't have this foundation of knowledge about nutrition, reading nutrition labels, for example, just something as simple as that, a lot of kids, I mean, even I didn't know how to, like, what it was to count calories until I was over 18 years old. And mm-hmm. that might seem like kind of a, you know, shocking thing to some people, but you know, there's a lot of people out there that I think just don't know where to turn for information.
So I think it's a great point. Let me start with you, Clyde Yancey, about Hannah's question. I mean, are you seeing people, do people have enough information to make good, healthy choices about this stuff?
So Hannah's question is beautiful. People do not have enough information. Children do not have enough information. It's very important that those food items that are made available in school environments and recreational environments really respect at least an opportunity to make a healthier choice. But what's even more important than the obesity cascade, which she so aptly described, is that in the early 20s, we already are seeing children that now are young adults with diabetes. We're already seeing the presence of high blood pressure in 20-year-olds. These things don't bode well for your future. So she is spot on, and we do need to revisit. How do we educate our families about diet and nutrition?
Lisa, I'd love you to take a crack at that question that Clyde Yancey put so well. How do we do a better job educating our families and our children?
I think we all have to, all health professionals, schools, we all have to give the same message. And I think it starts certainly in schools, where schools should be a place where we learn about health, we learn about eating properly, food, et cetera, the home. I think something important that's not been included in this discussion is the cost of food. Unfortunately, in this country, unhealthy food is cheap, and healthy food is much more expensive. You know, to go to McDonald's, I could get four items for $4, and, you know, broccoli is $4. So a lot of times the default is unhealthy food because it's cheaper. So I think that whenever you go to the doctor, the dentist, these are opportunities to talk about healthy eating, and we have to have probably some regulations.
Yeah.
From advertising on television to marketing food products to kids. I mean, it's getting better in this country, but kids are marketed. It's as though there's this food group for kids, and it has to be neon color food, and they have to look like dinosaurs. If you ever go to the supermarket and you go to the height of a child in a wagon, you could see what the world looks like through their eyes.
Yeah. So I love that neon-colored food that looks like dinosaurs. Yeah, no, I think it's really well expressed.
To rethink. There's no reason. We're one of the only countries that has children's menus in restaurants where they get, you know, fried chicken, milk, and ice cream.
But let me push back, Lisa, on one thing you said, or at least pose the question to Courtney. Courtney, Lisa said that, you know, one of the challenges here is bad food is cheaper. But is that really true? Aren't there healthy ways to buy whole, I mean, relatively affordable ways to buy whole food that's healthy?
Yes, there is, you know, especially with farmers markets in a lot of cities. There are always ways you can get more fruits and vegetables. If you go to a grocery store and go to the freezer aisle, you can just get the steamable bags of plain vegetables, and they're a dollar, sometimes less. So there is a way to make it work. I think that we need education across the board in schools and for parents.
Yeah.
And I just like to remind people that shaming children, so parents who may kind of get on their child's case about their weight or what they're eating, is one of the most harmful things we can do and can actually lead to further weight gain in the child. So it needs to be a positive setting in the home, and everybody needs to be on board and just talk about it as though it's a way of life. There should be no, you need to do this or else.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to get...
Anthony, may I answer, Chuck?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I take care of a number of patients who come from all walks of life, and this is a real challenge for those that have limited economic circumstances. I coach them, our team coaches them, to look at the menu in your fast food restaurant. If that's where you need to go, if that's your source of nutrition, look at the menu. I'm really struck that there are healthier choices within those menus. Maybe not ideal, but you can certainly make smarter choices. And I love to tell my patients, there's nothing good about a French fry, period.
There's nothing good about a French fry. Never, ever. Except they taste really good, Dr. Yancey, you got to admit. All right, our time runs low. Let's try to get one more call in. Yushe is calling from Tampa, Florida. Yushe, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I actually have kind of the opposite of most people because I actually have trouble gaining weight. And the problem is I don't want to drink milk or eat certain meats because of how they're processed and how they treat the animals. And in Tampa, you know, we don't have that many farmers markets and places to go to get organic things. And how am I supposed to gain weight when all these things are so expensive? And fast food is just the easier route for me.
All right, Yushe. Quick answer from you, Lisa. Our time is really running down, but give Yushe a quick answer.
There are many ways to gain weight healthfully, and I think that's critical. And that would be to add more fats to your diet, healthy fats, like to have more oils, healthy oils, to put avocado, put cheese on your sandwich.
Whole eggs, fatty fish, nuts.
Exactly.
Extra virgin olive oil, lots of nice. We sort of started the hour there talking about healthy fats. Our time is up. It's the tyranny of the clock. Lisa Sasson, professor of New York University, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Courtney Ferreira, dietitian and founder of the Real Food Court Nutrition Consulting, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks.
And Dr. Clyde Yancey, Chief of Cardiology at Northwestern School of Medicine. Clyde Yancey, it was great having you join the conversation. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.